KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Akutan, Alaska.
I'm a paleo nerd, don't you understand?
Hey, Ray!
Hi, Dave. How you doing, man?
I'm doing great. I was a little bit late today because I'm just putting tongue oil on my beehive.
You don't hear that every day, okay? Tongue oil on your beehive. Arthropods?
Yeah, I've never heard of tongue oil. It's a type of kind of varnish to paint on unfinished wood.
Yeah.
And I ordered a flow hive, which I put together. It's a beehive, which I will populate with a colony of bees in the spring.
Well, how do you do that? You go out, just grab a bee and, like, hey, throw them in there?
Well, I live in Ojai, California, which is a citrus-producing area. And there are beekeepers. They're called apiarists. A-P as in Paul. A-I-R-I-S-T, apiarists.
Oh,
apiarists.
Okay, something like that.
I'm probably...
You're slaughtering it. Meat.
Probably slaughtering it, yeah.
Whatever. So you're doing this just because you want some honey? I know you like honey in your coffee in the morning.
Yeah. I go through about 5 pounds of honey a month.
Really?
Maybe more.
What?
Yeah, and this is called a flow hive. Once your colonies are up and running and healthy, you literally walk out, put a jar underneath, turn a spigot, and the honey flows into your jar.
Do you have to do the whole suit thing with the...
Well, the flow hive, made in Australia, does come with the whole package. There's the suit and the smoker. And so, yeah, I'm going to be jumping into some very serious beekeeping rules, regulations.
I guess. Do you issue these suits to your guests? Should I come to Ojai again and hang out in your backyard?
No. This is only while handling the bees.
Oh, really?
And handling the... a beehive. And to be honest, I haven't jumped into it because I have months before spring arrives. And believe me, I'm going to dive deep into this to make sure I do it correctly and have healthy bees and a healthy colony.
Yeah.
And a safe one for me.
Wow. And you know, I guess our insect friends are suffering in the world, and bees in particular. And so you're doing your part to give them a home.
I think it's selfish.
Oh, you just want the honey.
I want the honey.
Hey, well, I want you to know that every time, you know, when we have a shower downstairs, and the spiders, just this morning, there's spiders that show up in my shower. I take them gently out into, I toss them outside. So just watch. I'm doing my part. So, yeah.
So our guest today, tell me how you found her. And
well,
I'm really excited because I jumped.
As you do. You found stuff out that I didn't even know about her. But today it is Madison Schriro, and I think that's how you pronounce it, Madison. I met her at the Geologic Society of America meeting about a month ago in California, and she was in line to have a book signed by Kirk Johnson and I, and we just started talking, and she just seemed cool and, you know, lots of fun, very personable. And then she told me she's a park ranger in Badlands. It's the jackalope capital of the world. So,
yeah, that's amazing.
Anyways.
And apparently, I've done this on Google Earth. You can see the Badlands from space. It is a great whitish scar that's visible from space.
And it's fossil heaven.
Yeah, Cenozoic fossils.
Yeah.
But you know what? Let's talk to the expert who works there.
Yeah. We're quickly out of our depth. That's why we turn to the expert.
Yeah,
so
I know.
Shall we call up Madison? Do you want to call her up, man?
Well, you know, I say let's get into like a 1920 jalopy, drive across the old Highway 66, which probably goes nowhere near there.
Yeah, I like it,
and,
too.
And arrive, and you honk the horn.
I'll honk it twice, and then Madison will be there. Hey, Dave, meet Madison Schriro, a geologist, a paleontologist, a geoscience communicator, and sometimes park ranger at Badlands National Park in South Dakota. Hey, Madison, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. I'm super excited to be here.
Hey, nice to meet you. I've watched you on video, so...
Oh, boy.
You know your stuff, so I want to get into this. This is going to be so much fun.
Well, thank you.
I think
super
the first
excited.
Thing we have to ask her, though, Dave, don't you think, is the question...
It's pretty obvious, because you even mentioned it in this one video I saw. Are you a paleo nerd?
Oh, I'm a paleo nerd.
All right.
How could you not be, right? Yeah, yeah. For me, the paleo nerddom goes back to basically the beginning of my life.
Well, I saw somewhere, you know, I know what your favorite dinosaur is. So you were one of those kids. It's Triceratops.
Oh, I don't.
Triceratops. You know, I got to say, I love Triceratops too, but, you know.
It's a classic,
it's a
right?
Classic. It's a classic. But where? What's your origin story, Madison? Where are you from?
Yeah, so the funny part was that I was never actually really a dinosaur kid.
What?
I mean, Triceratops was my favorite.
Okay, all right.
I had to choose, but I was more of an ammonite kid, which is maybe the nerdiest sentence I ever say. So that was kind of my gateway into all of it. I grew up, well, I was born in Atlanta, Georgia, and then moved to North Carolina. I grew up in Charlotte, North Carolina for most of my life. So not a place where you can very easily dig up any fossils.
Not any ammonites around there.
Do anything
there.
Like
yeah.
that. No, not so much. but I kind of just, you know, fell in love with it through rocks originally. I was more of a rock kid, you know, digging up rocks in my backyard and getting covered in hematite clay. And my mom's getting mad at me because my clothes are all covered in that, you know, iron staining.
Yeah.
But I love fossils. I was constantly reading all I could about paleontology and looking for every opportunity that I could to just, like, get out there and dig something up.
So dinosaurs really didn't have much to do with it. You were just into rocks and geology, and you knew early on you wanted to be a paleontologist.
Yeah, I've said since probably, God, since I was, like, 3 or 4 years old, when people would ask me what I wanted to be when I grew up, I always said a geologist and a paleontologist.
Wow.
You knew those words at 4 years old?
Yes, and I got to pause and tell one of my mom's all-time favorite stories, because there was once in kindergarten, I got a little confused, and I messed it up, and the teachers or whatever, they were asking everybody what they wanted to be when they grew up to write it down on some cute little worksheet for, like, back-to-school night for the parents. I told them I wanted to be a geologist and an alienologist. And they were like, are you sure that's a thing? And I was like, yeah. Have you not heard of that? Obviously it's a thing, you know, little 5-year-old me. And that's so cool. They wrote it down. My parents still joke about it, especially because, like, you know, I was into sci-fi for a while, still into sci-fi, obviously. They're like, you did end up as an alienologist in a way.
Well, I noticed that you call yourself a geologist before a paleontologist. You rank that top in your description, your self-description.
I put it first because it's what I accomplished first, I felt like.
Did you get a degree?
Yeah. So in undergrad, I studied geology. I got degrees in geology and art from Carleton College. Saw the thumbs up from Ray.
Mm-hmm. So then you could draw. You could draw the ages and not.
Yeah.
Not just
there we go.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's so fun. I think geology and art and paleontology, they just all go so hand in hand to me. It's so funny. There's people that I tell them that I majored in those two things, and they are beyond confused. They're like, how do those things go together? And I'm like...
Then you go, Rachel.
Those of us who get it, they get it.
Rachel.
I know Ray gets it.
Actually, Madison, before we dive into the paleo side of things, you said you're an art major as well. And so you're a double major in art? And what kind of visual art, I'm assuming visual art, did you do or do you do?
Yeah, so I primarily did 2D media, mostly painting, drawing, that sort of thing. I was really big into pen and ink work for a while, dabbled a lot in graphic design, but then I also found a love for metalworking in college.
Oh. Huh.
I became obsessed with it. I took as many classes as I could and independent
studies.
You mean
welding and bending and cutting and...
Yeah, mostly soldering, kind of smaller scale stuff, working with softer metals, but I loved it. And I was able to incorporate that into paleo as well, actually. I borrowed a couple of our teaching specimens one day and made these little molds of little ammonites and a little brachiopod, and I cast them in bronze, which was so fun.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's taking it to almost a professional level.
Yeah, you know, one of the things I've always thought with college departments and things, that's when the compartmentalizing begins, kind of like, so the art mm-hmm. majors stay over there, and the, you know, science people are over here, and then there's the jocks over there, and really
yep.
getting that interchange. And I saw somewhere... I just wrote this down, drawing the Anthropocene. Was that a project that you did?
Yeah, that was a class I was in, actually.
Okay.
It was this really neat class offered by my favorite art professor, actually over COVID. So we were doing this over Zoom, thinking about, you know, the intersections of
what is it, nuclear wasteland?
And,
is that the,
yeah.
what the Anthropocene is? An empty world of no humans?
Yeah, we had a lot of really interesting projects. My favorite was we discussed the passenger pigeon and the extinction of the passenger pigeon, and we each had to create some sort of visual drawing or something. I ended up doing an embroidery project, which he said counted as drawing. Yeah. Like the big thing you do at the end, of your major. And I ended up making a fake natural history museum exhibit for my art thesis. And I was like, I feel like you guys are going to love this.
A fake natural history museum?
Fake, is it what you mean, a replica? Or you mean it's something that doesn't really exist?
As in, I was taking, you know, artifacts, in quotes, in big quotes there, and found objects and creating new things, making them look old, etc. You know, I had this big geologic map that I cut up and repositioned and painted over, and then I made museum labels with like half truths in them, just enough to make it believable.
But this is of the Anthropocene.
So fun. Yeah, yeah. So
just for our listeners, I'm sure everybody knows, just tell everybody what the Anthropocene is, which has apparently just begun.
Yeah, so the Anthropocene is kind of the concept that we're in a new geologic era or time period that is kind of defined by human activity, which, you
which
know...
is not very nice.
It's not very nice, but it's, you know, it's true. I mean, humans are the largest erosional force on the planet, so it's not necessarily like new rocks that are being created right now all the time. Sometimes it's the destruction of rocks that already existed. Sometimes it's us, you know, digging things up and messing up the order of the natural stratigraphy. Sometimes it's the geochemical signatures that'll be left in the rocks, you know, from increased carbon in the atmosphere, etc.
Well, I don't think
and all the extinctions. Ugh.
I don't think it's been officially adopted yet, has it, right?
It hasn't.
You know, so obvious, but it hasn't been adopted, so we can't officially say that, but...
No.
Well, my question
it's
is,
it's a common term these days.
What body of science officially adopts this age? Is it the World Geologic Society or something? Or
God, I think there is some like international stratigraphers thing. Oh. I can never remember what it's called, but they like accept or deny.
Yes.
I'll find that and have a link to it in your episode.
Oh, perfect.
Well, anyways, there's a big turn in your career. You're actually fairly new out of the old undergrad world, right? So you said you did your senior stuff during COVID, which is in my time span, just like yesterday. But so let's fast forward the science thing. How do you end up being a park ranger? Or is there something in between there?
With a uniform, do you have a gun?
No, not that kind of park ranger. So there's two kinds. There's the law enforcement kind, and then there's the interpretation kind, and that's me. So I just get to tell people fun things. I don't have to deal with rule breakers all the time. Right. Basically, in undergrad, while I was still in undergrad, I started having a freak out because I was like, I don't have anything on my resume that says geology, paleontology, anything. Done a lot of classes, but I don't have any actual experience in the geosciences. So I started applying to summer internships, and I was like, I need to do something that's paid because I can't do an unpaid internship right now. And that led me to the government because there's a lot of great internships that kind of help you get a foot in the door, and they're paid positions, and they usually offer housing.
Oh, wow.
There's the scientists.
They're unpaid or paid?
They are paid.
Really? Oh. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they're awesome. I highly recommend to like every young geoscientist I know, like apply for some of these. There's the scientists in the parks program. That's for like the national parks specifically. The National Park Service, those can be a little competitive at times, especially the paleo positions within those internships. But there's also one called GeoCore America, which I think might be getting reworked soon. It might have a new title soon.
I'll try to find those links as well for upcoming scientists. Spread the word.
Yeah, exactly, right? We all need a way to get a foot in the door. But the GeoCore America internship is like basically the same thing, but for the Forest Service and Bureau of Land Management, I believe. And that's the one I ended up, well, I applied for all of the above, but that's the one I ended up hearing back from. And so I got an interview and got offered this internship out of Wall, South Dakota.
Oh, yeah. Wall Drug.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
We were talking
Wall
about
drug.
Wall Drug.
Dinosaur. I've got the bumper sticker on my car, you know? So.
Oh, good. I have one, too. Yeah. Yeah, if you listeners out there have never heard of Wall Drug, highly recommend a quick Google search there. It's an interesting place, and it sits right outside of Badlands National Park. But in the town of Wall, there is a little visitor center, little teeny tiny visitor center, called the National Grasslands Visitor Center, and that's operated by the U.S. Forest Service. And the National Grasslands are like the best kept secret in public lands. They are in the Forest Service, but they're not national forests, they're national grasslands. And there's so many great rock hounding opportunities on them, dispersed camping for free, like they're amazing. All this beautiful prairie landscape that's preserved by the Forest Service and nobody knows about it. And the only visitor center for all 20 national grasslands across the country is the one in Wall.
Really?
Wow.
Yeah,
well,
so
where are these grasslands besides, obviously,
oh, yeah.
I'm sure they're in the Great Plains, I'm sure. Are there any grasslands in states we wouldn't think there'd be national
yes.
grasslands?
Obviously, the majority of them are in the Great Plains. The reason the visitor center is in Wall is because one of the grasslands surrounds Badlands National Park. But there's three short grass prairies out west, I believe, Idaho.
That makes sense. Idaho, Utah, probably.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe Northern
I think it's
Utah,
Northern
yeah.
California, actually, maybe. And then there's a national tallgrass prairie an hour south of Chicago.
Oh,
really?
And then
yeah.
Kansas? Anything in Kansas?
There's the Cimarron National Grassland right. in Kansas, but then there's the like tallgrass prairie. That's a National Park Service site. It's confusing. It just depends
so
on like
cool.
which
well,
agency
so cool.
manages
So there
it.
You
yeah.
are in Wall, yeah. in Wall, South Dakota. How many humans live in Wall?
So the town sign says about 800.
Oh.
But, you know, not the smallest town I've ever lived in at this point, but not large either, but flooded with tourists every summer. Absolutely flooded with tourists.
Hmm.
So I ended up working out there with this internship with the Forest Service and just like... This was my first kind of foray into being an interpretive park ranger, somebody who literally does science communication as your job all day, every day.
Wow.
Like, of course,
so
you're
a grasslands person.
Yeah, yeah. I was a grasslands ranger originally.
That's so
put
cool.
Put that blade back.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Put that blade down
yeah.
there. All right. So, but then, yeah. so you're there in the grasslands, but how do you get over into the Badlands paleo end of things? Is there another visitor center?
Yeah.
Deeper in the
there
park.
Is. So we worked pretty closely with them when I was at the grasslands, and about half of my day every day was spent in the park just talking to visitors.
Okay.
It was the best part of the day. You know, just going out, chatting with people, teaching them about the geology, paleontology, history of the park. The grasslands are awesome, but they focus a lot more on the human history side of
right.
things, homesteading, stuff like that, and the biology and ecology, because they're a super important ecosystem. But obviously, my interest lies in the rocks and fossils, so... I started being like, oh, I should try to work at Badlands next because they focus more on that. They've got a fossil preparation lab on site. They've got these awesome exhibits. They've got, you know, collections on site where you can go and do research. It's awesome. So I worked one more summer at the Forest Service and then applied to the Park Service, switched teams. And so now I've done two summers and a winter at Badlands, and I just love it there. The White River Group is amazing. The White River Group
wow.
is the layers of rocks that are basically at Badlands. That's what they're referred to as a whole. And they're some of the richest fossil beds in the world, especially for the time period they preserve.
For Cenozoic
so. Mammals. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
What? Wait a minute.
Yeah.
There are no dinosaurs?
Oh, man.
No
oh,
dinosaurs
on. Didn't you
in the
do
Badlands.
The research? Dude, it starts at the Pierre Shale, which is the Western Interior Seaway bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And they found a mosasaur and some ammonites, right? And some belemnites.
Yeah.
Belemnites. Yeah.
Lots of clams.
Belemnites.
I was playing dumb.
Baculites.
I was playing dumb there.
Huh? I'd love you to describe the layer cake, starting
yeah.
with the Pierre
yeah.
Shale, and all the different, there's something that's yellow. There's a yellow cake
mm-hmm.
thing in there.
Yellow cake.
Describe what the layers are, but I want to know where all this stuff came from
yeah.
to build up sediment above the Pierre Shale.
This is a great question, and I love this. This makes me feel like I'm at work. This is like what I answer all day long. People are super interested
Tell
in learning
about, the
about geology.
What's
and
at the bottom where the plate is?
Exactly. Badlands has that beautiful stacked layer cake geology, which of course is an oversimplification, but it's a great way to think about it. And I always start people at the bottom. You got to start at chapter one of the story. We're going to use a classic like book analogy. Sure, layer cake, you got your different layers. Books,
pancakes,
you got your different chapters.
Pancakes.
Pancake steps, yeah. So chapter one is our Pierre Shale. It's spelled Pierre, but it's pronounced Pierre because the Midwest is weird and
Pierre.
I don't know.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
my only explanation. Yeah.
Pierre Shale.
The Pierre Shale is
oh.
this amazing, dark, you know, organic rich looking shale that was deposited in the Western Interior Seaway, which was this vast inland
yep.
sea that stretched all the way from the Arctic Circle down through the Gulf of Mexico, kind of split the North American continent in two for a little while. By a little while, I mean many millions of years, of course.
And some of the finest ammonites come from that layer. in the world.
Yes, I have found some ridiculous ammonites out there in my day at this point, and they have the most gorgeous aragonite preservation.
They are
it's
cool.
Beautiful.
World renowned.
They're super cool.
Anyways, I jump back in. Take us up the layers.
Yeah, yeah. So if you're situating yourself at Badlands National Park, which is in southwestern South Dakota, and 75 to 69 million years ago, if you're standing there, you would have been at the bottom of the Western Interior Seaway. We would have been under about 400 meters of water is the estimate.
Really? That's a lot of water.
Yeah, it varied over time. There were certainly times where we were much closer to the shoreline, but that was probably about the deepest it ever got at that spot.
Hmm.
So we preserve at Badlands just the tail end of the lifetime of that seaway, basically, 75 to 69 million years ago. And then something happened, right? Obviously, the middle section of North America isn't underwater anymore.
Right.
So what happened? I always ask people, what happened? What could
didn't
have caused
rise?
The entire seaway to go away?
Didn't it get compressed from either end and kind of rose in elevation?
Yeah, basically, the Rocky Mountains happened.
The Laramide orogeny pushed the seaway.
Yeah, pushed up the midsection of the continent just a little. Badlands didn't get crumpled into mountains or anything like that, but it just got pushed up, and the seaway was kind of forced to recede to the north and south. And so we were left above sea level. And that's when the story gets really fun. Even though I could spend forever on the Western Interior Seaway, I love the Western Interior
As do
Seaway.
I, yes.
But I thought I was going to be an ammonite paleontologist, but now I'm in the mammal world, so Badlands is perfect. I get a bit of both. So something really fun happens in our layer cake geology at that point. The layer turns bright yellow. The next layer you get is bright yellow. It's called the Yellow Mounds Formation. And the easiest way to explain the Yellow Mounds Formation is it is basically the top section of the pier shale altered after the fact.
I remember
so when that seaway, when it retreated.
It's the dried out bit that laid there for a million years.
Yeah, exactly. So it was exposed to the air for the very first time. The pier shale had always been underwater. And there's this weird iron mineral in there called goethite. It reacted with the air and the remaining water that was left around, and it essentially rusted, but it turned yellow. Rather than red.
So is that Cretaceous stuff? Or is it remnants of the Cretaceous in the Eocene? Is that how
So it is Cretaceous stuff. It's that same. It's the same age as the top of the pier shale.
Okay.
And now if we want to get into more detail for the geologists in the crowd, it's not technically a pier shale.
Right.
It's this other formation called the Fox Hills Sandstone.
There you go. All right. That's it. I know
typically.
That one. All right.
Yeah. And so that represents the shoreline, right? Sand is closer to the shore. Shale is a little further out at sea. So we were getting closer to the shoreline at that point. But it's still that Western Interior Seaway stuff.
Okay.
So it's still in the late Cretaceous. But it was altered to turn yellow in the Eocene when it was exposed at the surface.
Got it.
And then at the top of the Yellow Mounds, I always tell people, go out and find the contact, the very top of the Yellow Mounds and the bottom of the next formation above it. If you go and you stick your hand on that layer, you're touching 32 million years of missing time, not recorded in the rock record. That
really?
Would be an unconformity.
Unconformity is a gap.
Yeah.
Wow.
Erosion.
Super fun.
It was
erosion,
it was
yes.
erased.
Bye-bye.
Yes.
It was totally erased.
There was deposition and then that got erased through erosion?
I mean, we don't know 100%
right.
for sure, but it's much more likely that something was deposited and then eroded away rather than just
okay,
no
deposition
at
all. Okay, wait, what's on top of what is missing? Ash?
So what's next is the Chadron Formation, and it's partially ash, partially volcanic ash, but it contains other sediment as well.
Right. But how do we know something was missing, though? How do you know if it's not there?
Well, the fossils
Great
tell
question.
You that.
The fossils tell you. Well, the rocks tell you
so
too,
you,
but we're going to
okay.
focus on the fossils.
Okay.
So we're
so
seeing
the
our ammonites.
Fossils are time markers.
Yeah, we're seeing our ammonites, we're seeing our clams, we're seeing our mosasaurs, and then all of a sudden they disappear. And the next layer up, you're finding things like brontotheres and land tortoises.
Yeah.
And all sorts of cool late
Eocene
20
million
mammals.
Years after everything dried up.
Yeah, we skip like 30 million years forward
right.
in time. And it's so fun to try to explain that to visitors who don't have any background in geology. They're like, wait a minute, it doesn't record everything? I'm like, no. It's actually super common that time is just erased from the rock record. That's why it's such a hard puzzle to put together.
So you skip the Paleocene and you go right to the end of the Eocene because you've got titanotheres,
mm-hmm.
a.k.a. brontotheres, thunder beasts. They are so
these
cool.
These giant, giant, the largest of all North American mammals.
They are so cool.
About.
Yes.
Is that the one with the slingshot?
Yeah, slingshot
yeah,
nose.
Yeah, they're like, imagine like a really large rhino with like a slingshot nose instead of horns, and you kind of get
yeah.
the idea of what
yeah.
a brontothere looks like. But fun fact, they're actually probably more closely related to modern horses than rhinos, but there's still a little bit of a debate going on there.
They're closer to horses than rhinos.
Artiodactyls?
Parasodactyls.
Yeah, ungulates, but they're parasodactyls, odd type of mammals.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, so artiodactyls have two?
Two or four.
Two or four.
Parasodactyls have five or three or one.
Right.
They're sort of the odd ones, yes, the odd toes.
Yeah,
the
yeah.
Even toes. So there, I didn't.
I'll have links to parasodactyls and artiodactyls in your episode page.
So you said they're closer to horses than to rhinos?
I've heard some debate back and forth, but they're somewhere in that larger parasodactyl group. But there's some studies still going on with the brontotheres. It's pretty interesting.
So fabulous fossils of brontotheres are found there, and then there's a turnover, right? Another layer.
Yeah, so at that point, when we get into our Shadrin formation, we're into the late Eocene. So we talked about skipping 32 million years of time. We've skipped a lot. We've skipped the extinction of the dinosaurs. We've skipped the rise of the mammals. We're smack dab in the middle of the age of mammals now, basically halfway between the end of the dinosaurs and humans today. We are smack dab in the middle. And that's when we get into our Shadrin formation, which at Badlands represents a very swampy Florida-like environment. We also have alligator fossils in that layer.
Ooh, nice.
At Badlands, you know, in South Dakota.
Nice.
So clearly very different than what was going on or what's going on today. And then above that, we get into the Brule formation, which is, you know, a fan favorite for mammal paleontologists. and the Brule Formation represents...
That's spelled B-R-U-L-E,
B-R-U-L-E,
right?
Yeah, exactly. The Brule...
Was that a Native American tribe?
Yes, yes. And there's a Brule County, so and there's a ton of things
right.
named after Brule, yeah. We get into kind of like a cooler and drier environment. We start progressing from that swampy Florida-like environment up into more of like an open woodland, eventually moving towards a scrubland, and then at the very top of the Badlands rock record, we start evolving the grasslands ecosystem for the very first time, which is super fun. But if we focus on just the layers above the Cretaceous, so we've got our Shadrin Formation, above that we have our Brule Formation, and at the very top there's this fun little one called the Sharps Formation. That takes us from about 37 to 28 million years ago. And all of that sediment, you were asking where it came from, it primarily came from the Black Hills, which are this cute little tiny blob of a mountain range to the west of the Badlands. And they kind of uplifted along at the tail end of the Laramide Orogeny, I believe. Once they uplifted, they, of course, started eroding away.
They had tons of erosional deposits onto the Badlands.
Exactly.
And what are the two river systems that eroded the Badlands from a flat prairie to all the way down to the Pierre Shale?
Yeah, so once the sediment was all shed from the Black Hills and it built up and built up and built up for like 10 million years, mixed in with volcanic ash, by the way, but the volcanic ash was not coming from the Black Hills. It was coming from...
Yellowstone, Oregon, California.
Actually, the Great Basin area down in Nevada and Utah.
Oh,
yeah, even
really?
Further. Yeah, so we've got one volcanic ash at 30 million years ago that's huge. It represents an eruption 5 to 6 times the size of a Yellowstone eruption.
Wow.
So,
oh, really?
Massive
wow.
event, yeah. Super neat.
What's that called?
It's called the Rockyford Ash or the Cedar Pass White Layer.
You know, those sound like country western songs to me.
They kind of do.
So let me just ask you just a couple. So we've got Eocene rocks. We've got Oligocene.
Yes.
And is there anything above that? Miocene? Are we in, that's it?
We do not get into the Miocene, no.
Okay.
But if you want to get technical, we have some gravels that appear every once in a while that are Pleistocene.
Well.
But that's...
Yeah, that's kind of... But actually, I showed Dave this.
Yeah.
So there's these geologic ages, you know, that we all know, Eocene, Oligocene, all that.
Hold it up, Rake.
Here is the Nauma.
The Nauma one. Oh, my gosh. Yes.
North American land mammal ages. And I did this for the Cruise of the Fossil Coastline book with Kirk. And they don't correspond exactly to, this is for the mammal people, you guys, you mammals out there, and you mammal lovers. This is a whole different nomenclature. So the Nauma ages, do you know them at all?
Yeah, Madison? Yeah. So the North American land mammal ages are a really helpful tool for us mammal paleontologists, and probably not a helpful tool for anybody else, but it's helpful for us because the rock record, you know, the geologic time scale, that's those time periods, the Eocene, the Oligocene, all of those that we've been talking about, they're named off of, you know, changes in the rocks usually, not
right.
changes in the fossils.
Right.
The North American land mammal ages allow us to designate different chunks of time where it's like, okay, there's this major turnover in our mammal assemblages, but we're still in the same rock formation. But we need to find a way to designate the difference. And a lot of times they will line up every once in a while. Like we have the Shadronian land mammal age, which is in represented in our Shadron formation at Badlands. And then when you get up into the Brule formation, you skip up into the Orellan land mammal age.
Yes, so Orellan, which sounds like Orwellian, but Orellan. And these are these ages are named for the areas or the actual towns or that they, these fossils are found in. So the Shadronian is for Shadron, Nebraska, and Orellan is from the, well, the Brule formation in Nebraska. But
well, this NALMA graphic really shows for you mammal paleontologists where these fossils are found and when they were found.
Yeah.
And it's a great demonstration.
It is. It is.
Well, thanks. And you can use it, Madison, if you want in your teaching stuff. But it does.
I would love to.
It's really, it's out there for the world to use, and except for on T-shirts.
But hey, so back to the Badlands. If you were to look out over it, how many layers are there? Like when you could see the deepest in one, if I were to have my camera and take a photo, how many do you see at once?
So it depends on where you are. And I love this question because if you're looking at it from like a non-geologist perspective, if you're standing there and you're a normal person, you're like, oh my God, there's so many layers, but there's only a couple of formations. So the Brule formation is filled with tons and tons of layers. There's these red layers alternating with beige, alternating with red, alternating with beige. And those are ancient soil horizons called paleosols.
Ah.
You've got all of these layers. It's beautiful.
You mean they're based on a deposition from rivers? They're based on deposition from wind? They're based on deposition from ash in one formation?
Yep, kind of all of the above. Yeah, mostly braided river channels coming off of the Black Hills and kind of building that sediment up over time. But, you know, wind likely played a role. And then you have that volcanic ash coming in, building up, and you mentioned earlier, eventually being carved out by a river system. That's the White River, which is why we call these rocks the White River Group. So the White River started that erosion. It kickstarted the erosion of Badlands. It started carving down into these layers. And that rock was never buried long enough to become hard and compact like we think of most rock being, so it eroded fast. We're talking like an inch per year on average across the park, still today.
Oh, so wait, when was this a flat, prairie?
Oh, when all of those layers got deposited, like
100,000 years ago, recently?
Yeah, yeah, and it started getting carved out about 500,000 years ago.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and then another Badlands will be gone. So I always tell people, get out there while you can, you know?
How many more years do we have? How many?
Half a million.
Oh, I'll be around. But I have a question. Ray gives great notes for me to dive into.
I love studying
all this. I think I knew this once, but I had forgotten that limestone can form at the bottom of the ocean from coccolithophores and all the little calcite sea creatures. Then it can be uplifted onto a mountain.
Mm-hmm.
Then it can erode off that mountain and be deposited again as a limestone layer, but it's not limestone from the ocean.
That's true.
Is that am I correct?
Yeah, I think I've heard of that. I don't know if there's like a like different terminology for that sort of thing.
But there's no limestone in the Black Hills.
There
was, because that was underneath.
Hills, yeah.
Yeah.
But when it got redeposited, when some of that sediment got redeposited at Badlands, it was mixed with all sorts of other stuff from the Black Hills, and we end up with kind of just a generic mudstone and siltstone.
Right.
We do have some thin layers of limestone at Badlands, but they're mostly, they were mostly deposited either by groundwater or in localized lake systems. Not so much limestone coming directly off of the Black Hills.
Okay. That's what I'm thinking of by groundwater, but I think limestone basically dissolves because of acid rain.
Yeah, so in the Black Hills still today, you've got sites like Jewel Cave National Monument and, Wind Cave National Park. There's that big limestone formation in the Black Hills, and those cave systems were created through the dissolution of that limestone. Yeah.
Right.
Basically, slightly acidic water percolating through the ground and dissolving some of the limestone away.
Well, back to fossils for just a second. Before we talk about a very tiny little creature, which I know is near and dear to your heart, before we get to that, you see my pun there. But anyways,
you're talking about the Mary Quillodon today?
Not yet, Dave. I wanted to ask.
Oh, sorry. I just wanted to show off.
He's showing off again.
He practices my flowers.
Madison. So in 1997, there's a couple of photographers that like, there's a bone here.
Mm-hmm.
And they did the right thing.
They did the right thing.
They didn't pick it up.
Super important.
They didn't. They did the right thing. You know, they went in and they took a picture.
What is the right thing?
They find this thing these bones, and it turns into the big pig dig. But the right thing to do, Madison, is?
The right thing to do, if you find a fossil in any national park, in any public land for that matter, is to leave it exactly where it is. We have to know exactly where it came from. Please leave it right where you found it.
Right where it is.
Then take photos. I always tell people, if you want to get an A+ in taking photos, you can have something for scale in there. You can take photos of your surrounding landscape as well. That's super helpful to the paleontologist.
Something for scale. You mean like a key
or a pencil.
A hand.
You know,
coin.
Not a hand as much. Something that we know the size of, right?
Oh, okay. Oh, all right.
Or if you, you know, are a big old nerd and you carry a scale bar around in your pocket like some of us, then you can just pull that out. Super easy. But you get your photos, and then if you get GPS coordinates, that's like the best thing you can do. The easiest way I've found to do this is I just open up my compass app on my phone, and it has the coordinates right there, and I just take a screenshot. So it's in my camera roll right after the fossil find.
Cool.
Otherwise, you can like...
Doesn't iPhone, when you enable location services, it takes the GPS location?
It's supposed to, but I've found with places where there's not a lot of cell service, which is where you're usually finding fossils, it doesn't always work perfectly. So I always like to have a little backup.
Great.
Yeah, and then you report it to the proper authorities. In this case, they reported it to Badlands.
It turns into this enormous dig. 19,000 fossils come out of the Big Pig Dig. Why do they call it the Big Pig Dig?
Excellent question. So the majority of the bones that were excavated during this 15-year-long excavation, by the way.
Wow.
15 years. They excavated an area the size of a tennis court and, like you said, pulled out more than about 19,000 bones. The vast majority of those bones belong to a really fun paleo animal here called the entelodont, or the big pig, or the hell pigs. Hell pigs. These guys are hell so pigs. Fun. I know. Yeah. Hell pig. Ray's one of Ray's favorites.
Ray coined the phrase, yeah. Hell pig. Did you?
I like to say that Kirk Johnson and I started calling it, it was called a Terminator pig, that we started calling it the Hell Pig, Kirk and I, but entelodonts, I say entelodonts, some people say entelodonts.
I've heard, yeah.
And whenever you say pig, you're going to get immediately corrected.
And I say you wouldn't want to meet one alone with, unless you're armed.
No, you would not.
These things were nasty. Nasty carnivores, scavengers.
One of my coworkers and I, when we worked for the Forest Service, we actually found an entelodont out there in Badlands. And the canine on that thing was like the size of a T-Rex canine. Yeah, it was a large individual. These things are crazy.
So there's a lot of work that still needs to be done on a lot of those entelodonts, because the Archaeotheria and their variations, they're just gigantic. But I think of them as they're very aggressive omnivores. But that's an incredible number of bones that have come out. You said they primarily were the hell pigs coming out of that?
Yeah, there was definitely...
Why so many omnivores?
There were...
How many individuals?
I don't know if we have a count on how many individuals, because there a lot of things were kind of a jumbled mess. There wasn't a lot of articulated specimens, but it was a lot.
Well, if you count skulls...
We'll have to go back and do a count in the collections. I'm not sure if they have that or not, but it's a lot of fossils. And yeah, the majority of them were these big pigs, but there was tons of other animals represented there as well.
But this is a drying water hole that got smaller and smaller.
Yeah, so basically the site is interpreted as this drying water hole in, you know, like a water hole that probably was recurring annually, but then your climate's drying out, so maybe the water's not coming back. Maybe the animals are dying there, waiting for the water to come back. Maybe it's kind of becoming this muddy mess that they're getting stuck in. And then, you know, scavengers like our big pigs could come in and try to snatch some of these smaller creatures up and maybe get stuck themselves or die there as well, kind of building up this bone bed over time. Yeah.
Wow. I didn't know they were that dense. I've been so inspired by hell pigs. I've written a couple songs about hell pigs. Have you heard those?
I don't think I have. I need to listen to those.
Oh, we have a ballad version too, the slow, the very sad one about, you know, the hell pigs. And then the heavy metal version.
Oh.
Hell pig. Oh, hell pig.
I should make a video about hell pigs.
Please. I would be honored.
That'd be awesome.
I would really be honored.
More people need to know about these. I'm always telling people, like, mammals, fossil mammals are just as cool, if not cooler, than dinosaurs. And I think the hell pigs are the perfect example of that.
Amen.
I think they were featured in one of the Walking with Dinosaurs, when they did the Cenozoic, they had some it was the old time CGI, but it was not so bad. You know, that would be a great horror film, is to resurrect that one of them in current CGI and have it go through a town and tear things and people apart.
I would stand in line for a Hell Pig movie.
Oh, yeah.
I would, you know, the flaming stuff. But anyways, there's a segue here, perhaps, to a woman by the name of Tiffany Leone. Who one day was out there, and she was an intern as well.
Yeah, remember those Scientists in the Parks internships I was talking about?
Yeah.
That was her?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, it used to be called Geoscientists in the Parks back when she was doing it.
Tell us what happened.
She was out there, I think it was her first week on the job, which this always happens. This always happens. This is how it always goes. It's your first week or your first day.
You go out,
you're exploring in the White River Group for the first time. You're looking for fossils and you find something amazing and you can never top it. So she was out there. She was exploring around and she found this teeny tiny little skull. Could fit right in your palm. It's this adorable little skull. And she did all those right steps, right? She left it where it was. She took photos, got coordinates, and reported it to one of the paleontologists at Badlands. And they went out and collected this specimen and brought it back to the lab. And it belongs to this teeny tiny type of deer. This group, well, they're not true deer. They're called the leptomericids. I always tell people, think of like a tiny, smaller than house cat sized deer that's kind of potato shaped with like toothpicks for legs. And you get an idea of what they look like. If you've ever seen modern chevrotains or like dictics, that's kind of what these little deer look like.
I've seen those in the zoo.
Yeah.
They're little tiny forest deer.
Exactly. Yeah, so we used to have those in North America. Not exactly related. They were their own separate group, but they're probably related in some way. We just haven't figured it out yet. But she found this tiny, tiny deer skull. And the fun thing about these leptomericids is that they're actually one of the most common fossil finds in the Badlands. They're up there. I mean, obviously, you've got your oreodonts. They're at the top. They're the most common. We've got our turtles, our tortoises, all sorts of stuff. But you find a ton of these tiny little jaws belonging to these deer. But nobody ever finds a skull for whatever reason. There's tons of jaws. There are lots of skulls out there. Because these tiny deer were only named based on characters in the teeth on the lower jaws, they were like, we got to separate the lower jaw from this specimen and look at those teeth and figure out which species it is. Because there are a couple species of teeny tiny deer that existed in the Badlands. And the most common one is called Leptomeryx evansi. And this is going to be very confusing because all of the species names start with E and it's hard to keep track of, but we'll do our best.
Wait, is Leptomeryx the family?
Leptomeryx is the genus.
The genus, and then the species is the next word.
Yes.
Yeah, so
the one you found is called?
It was called Leptomeryx
Ellisae,
which was not the most common one, Leptomeryx evansi.
I'm sorry, the one you wrote, she found it, but you wrote the paper on it, right?
Exactly, yeah. So she found it back in 2016. Our amazing prep lab manager, Mary Carpenter, prepped it beautifully, removed that lower jaw, and we were able to identify it as Leptomeryx ellisae, which was a species of Leptomeryx written up in 2002. Nobody had mentioned it in any paper since then, because people don't really pay attention to these tiny little oligocene deer. And so I came along a few years ago at Badlands, and I was super excited to get involved in paleo research. And one of my coworkers, who was then my co-author on this paper, Ed Welsh, he was like, hey, we have this skull. It belongs to Leptomeryx ellisae, which is this species that nobody really talks about. And also, by the way, nobody has ever seen a skull to it before. This is the first one to ever exist. And I was like, oh, we should probably write that up. So it started out as a very simple project. We were planning to, you know, write a description of this skull, add it, you know, either validate the species, or if it ended up looking a lot like the other Leptomeryx species, we were going to combine it into something else. That was the original plan, right?
Right.
Just getting that resource out there so other people could, you know it exists and learn from it too. And then you should never start a research project by saying it's going to be simple and easy. Just a word of advice to everybody. Never say that, because then it always gets complicated. We started looking and we were like, okay, hold on. This skull is actually super weird. It doesn't look like any other Leptomeryx skull of any other species.
Therefore.
Yeah, super weird.
New
ding, ding,
species.
Ding is right.
New genus.
We were like,
new genus.
But the species already existed.
What?
That's where it gets confusing. Yeah. So the species, yeah, the Leptomeryx ellisae,
right.
The ellisae part was valid. It's like nobody had seen a skull at that point. If you look at just the teeth, the people who named that species in 2002, they were exactly right. It was a different species. The differences in the teeth were there. But what they didn't have was all of the cranial features from the skull to say, oh, this isn't just a new species. This is a whole new genus. It's a whole new group. So when we're looking at our skull, its teeth look like the genus Leptomerix, but the features of the skull look like this other genus of teeny tiny deer that shows up 10 million years later in the Miocene.
Oh.
But the teeth don't match that guy, and the skull doesn't match Leptomerix. And so,
you've got a proto new mm-hmm. genus.
Yeah, so we couldn't fit it into any existing group, so we basically had to create a new group for it.
That's a big thing to take on. Like, that's your first paper.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, this was my first publication, so I was pretty excited about it.
That's so cool.
It was awesome, yeah.
That's why I love the title, The Tiny Deer with Big Implications.
Yes, thank you. That was my call there.
I know the name of it, but I'm not going to say it. Tell us how you came up with its name, which is?
Yeah, the name is Santusi merix. So the full name would be Santusi merix ellisei.
Ellisei.
Yeah, so Santusi is a name of somebody. We'll get to that. But the merix ending is ruminant. So it's Santusi's ruminant. And Santusi is Vincent Santusi. He is the senior paleontologist for the National Park Service. He's a good friend and colleague of ours, and we decided to name this find after him. And then Mammoth Cave National Park went and named a new species of shark after him. We were like, well, we can't have that. We got to one-up him. So we went and named a new genus after him.
Vincent's brilliant. He's got all these accolades. I've met Vincent a couple times. Yeah, he's...
Yeah.
Yeah, it's great.
He's an awesome, awesome guy. He's always been a huge supporter of everything we do at Badlands and especially our fossil preparation lab. So we were super excited to get to name this after him.
We'll get him on the show sometime. So, Madison, I've seen a lot of your stuff on social media. I met you at the GSA meeting, and you are a great believer in science communication and the importance thereof. Why?
Oh, yes. I think there is such an unfortunate gap right now between the world of scientists and the world of everyday people. And there's this general mistrust of scientists, even among the general public, that has kind of festered over years of scientists not really putting an emphasis on communicating their science to the public, which is more important than you might think, especially when it comes to things like climate science and conservation. Right. So I think it is super, super important for all of us to work on communicating things to the general public. And this is definitely, my work in science communication is definitely inspired by my work as a park ranger, you know, chatting with everyday people coming to these national parks who are so, so excited and so enthusiastic about learning about, you know, the geologic history of the place, you know, all of these ancient animals that used to exist there. And they're so passionate about it, but they don't know where to start because geology is not usually a high school graduation requirement. Most people aren't even ever exposed to it. So you have to give them that point to jump in, right? Because otherwise you don't have the background knowledge, it feels overwhelming, and you never learn about it. So my whole goal with science communication is to give people that jumping in point, to make it fun, accessible. My colleague Max Scott and I have adopted is laughing and learning. That's like our whole take on science communication. He and I work very closely together to create fun and accessible videos and other content for people. The more people understand and connect to the natural world around them, the more they'll care about it and the more they'll do to protect it.
Well, you know, amen. And I think that's what Dave and I are trying to do here on our show too.
Make it fun, engaging.
But yeah, the videos that you and Max do are really very fun. And
thank you.
So you can find them on Instagram and TikTok. Are you there? YouTube?
Yeah, where are your Instagram outlets? Instagram. TikTok, haven't posted anything on YouTube yet.
You know, I think one of the reasons why Americans have a problem with science and there's a greater distrust in science is science education has been lacking the last 30, 40 years and
mm-hmm.
been underfunded in just regular
Absolutely.
Public schools. When a scientist makes a statement and backs it up with data and graphs and the general public can't read or understand that data or graphs, it's much easier to believe that the earth is flat because a YouTube video shows you proof rather than a rocket scientist showing you apogees, inertia, and that type of stuff.
Which I also think is where art comes into this conversation, right? Graphic design, figures.
Art is
a
great...
If you can make a figure or a graph that is actually digestible to people, rather than just, you know, your Excel standard, you know, chart that people look at and they want to fall asleep.
Graph,
Like, if you can make something fun and engaging, then you're going to get the point across a lot better to people.
And I think communicating, you know, the visual, I try to craft an image that you get, you know, you get it at a glance. And I'm wondering, Madison, before we kind of wrap things up, do you do some of the social media then as part of your job with the government?
So everything I do on my page is done on my own time. That's all, you know, as it says in my bio, all opinions are my own, not affiliated with the government in any way.
Yeah.
I never really liked social media, but through this lens of science communication, I've grown very fond of it, actually, because it's kind of fun. So it did eventually kind of bleed over into my work as a park ranger. I collaborated with one other ranger at the Badlands, and she and I were the co-leads for the Badlands National Park page this last summer. Okay. We had a lot of fun making, you know, fun content about the park, covering all sorts of topics, fun videos. We increased the followers by like a ton. It was a great time.
I love that idea, laugh and learn.
Yeah,
it's so great.
It's simple, but it works, right? And that's kind of the approach I take at work as well. I give, you know, presentations for people all day long. And one I do, it's about the Western Interior Seaway. When I was creating it, it's like this 30-minute evening program that's like a PowerPoint presentation, which sounds really boring. So I was like, I need to make this fun and accessible for anybody and everybody. So I was like, okay, my audience is kids. I'm just going to say my audience is kids. You got to make it fun. Western Interior Seaway. Okay, there was an ocean here. Ocean of grass, you know, the prairie. You can kind of combine these things. And then I started thinking, okay, pirate-themed adventure through the Western Interior Seaway. We're going on a treasure hunt looking for these fossils, but we're going to, you know, we're not going to take the treasure. We're going to do the right thing and report it. And I've gotten such great feedback from that program that I give that I call Pirates of the Cretaceous. But it kind of like has bled over into all of the other stuff I
did. You should pitch that. I'd watch that movie too.
Yeah, Pirates of the Cretaceous. Wouldn't that be fun?
Right.
Yeah. Somebody called Johnny Depp or something.
That's a perfect combo. Dinosaurs and pirates. I love it. Mm-hmm. Marine reptiles. But I've got a big question here for you.
A big question. Okay.
A big question. So, Madison, if you could go back in time, what exciting epoch? What perfect period? What exquisite era would you go back to, and what would you want to see?
Oh man, so I think about this all the time.
Okay, one chance.
Oh, okay. I feel like I have two. I feel like I have two answers.
Yeah, one. Let's do the one.
Give her whatever she
all
wants.
Right.
To say.
Number one, and then number two.
Okay, if I had to go with just one, I feel like it's obvious. I want to be at the Badlands. I want to see one hell pig fighting another. I want to see this amazing American Serengeti that we had, this you know, Oligocene environment with all of these cool creatures running around. I want to see my little deer and see how, you know, close we were with our reconstruction, and just watching that ecosystem take place.
So
would
25
be
million years ago.
More like
the legacy.
Yeah, I guess I would want to go a little earlier than that. I'd be like, I want to choose like 32 million, if we're getting specific.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
You know, I'm just thinking
about...
that
is the Orwellan.
Yeah.
Orwellan, yes.
Orwellan era.
Think about your tiny deers as a little hell pig snack.
I know, literally it would be so easy to snatch
so
right up, right? I mean, the deer weighed like 3 to 5 pounds, and Antilodont would be like perfect.
Yeah.
And you know, if you dip it in that little yellow, what do you call that?
The yellow mound.
Sediment.
Yellow story. Yellow...
nice little
mustard.
Condiment. It's perfect. Yeah.
Yeah.
So
that's
what's
my
your
primary
second
answer.
One? Yeah, what's your second one?
I just want to see the weird little guys of the Ediacaran. I just want to know what they look like.
Oh, Ediacaran.
Pre-Burgess Shale. I want to see what those little weirdos look like in real life.
I've seen the Dickinsonian, the actual fossils, in the Adelaide Museum.
Those things are crazy.
They are.
Super
weird. And there is a question, are they animals or are they plants? So
yeah, I feel like those would be really hard to study. I like bones and teeth. Bones and teeth make things easy.
They're aliens, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
Well, my question is, I'm going to kind of take a left turn here, because you kind of answered the question I was going to ask.
Oh, yeah?
Well, your work highlights the incredible potential of citizen science.
Yeah.
And I love that. Laugh and learn is a great way to approach it. And with your discovery of Santu, was it?
Santucci Marix, yeah.
Santucci Marix.
Santucci Marix LSA is evidence of your enthusiasm in paleontology. But my grand question I was going to ask you has been answered, so I want to get down and dirty.
All right.
What are the worst things you've seen in the park? Careless actions? Or theft?
Dumb.
Or just general human stupidity? Right?
I'm like,
one or two of the worst things you've seen. And then how do you think you can ever prevent these things from happening again? Because they will.
They will, yes. Oh, man.
Humans are stupid.
There have been some interesting stories at Badlands. Obviously, fossil theft. It happens all the time. We try to avoid it. Yeah. And it's teaching people, educating them on citizen science and how they can report fossils has been a huge help. But that's a big one. I'm trying to think of like the funniest.
How do you know they're gone? You'll see just a big shovel hole in the ground.
Sometimes.
That was something.
Yep.
Yeah.
Do you stop them on the way out? Frisk them?
We've caught a couple before. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good to know.
Earlier this summer, even some of our own, there was a geology club out there taking rock hammers to our rocks. And we were like, are you kidding me?
Well,
come on, guys. In a national park. Yeah. You got to have a permit to do that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But I think really the biggest thing, that if you want to go like the stupidest thing that visitors do, it's always the wildlife. They get too close.
Yeah.
They
get close to the buffalo. And
they're like walking up to the buffalo.
And there's pronghorn out there.
Pronghorn and bighorn sheep. I'm like, that thing has 30 pounds of horn on its head. Maybe don't walk right up to it. And then the prairie dogs. The prairie dogs are such a problem at Badlands, because every once in a while, such as last summer, for an example, they can get the plague. And I mean bubonic. And then people are like out there trying to feed them. And I'm like, oh my God, please don't. Oh, yeah, don't feed wildlife in general, but like definitely don't feed the wildlife that can give you the plague, right?
Wow. Okay, I didn't know
that.
I think
36 hours will lock you up in your house.
I thought maybe there were...
buboes start growing in your groin and lymph node areas.
Right.
When prairie dogs attack, bubonic prairie
there's
dogs.
There's our other movie.
So, yeah, there's the other movie.
Yeah,
but
the other movie.
Killer prairie dogs. But do people, you know, in the lust for cool, you know, finding cool fossils or whatever, so I could go there, I could go out and look, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if
see
something...
Look.
You know, if I see something, say something, go back, as they say.
Right,
yes,
say something. But, yeah, this isn't true of every park, I should clarify. I always feel like I should clarify, because you can't walk everywhere in every park.
That is actually
very rare. We're what's called an open hike park, which means you can walk anywhere you like. You don't have to stick to the trails, but a lot of parks you do have to stick to the trails.
Right.
But Badlands, yes, you can come and look for fossils anywhere.
You can walk right. Can't you skip through all the hydrothermal poles at Yellowstone barefoot?
Yeah. What?
Aren't you allowed to do that?
You know, swimming in the hot spring? Yeah, right.
Swimming in the hot spring.
Oh, God. I would never want to work at Yellowstone.
Oh my goodness.
I used to joke about having this program about why Badlands is better than Yellowstone. It was going to be, we have Yellower Stone because of the Yellow Mounds.
Yeah.
better bison, better visitors, and something about we won't blow up and end the world. You know, a couple things
there
like that.
You go.
Well, do people wander off into the Badlands and then they're
lost,
never seen again?
It does happen every once in a while, but not as often as you might think. I'm on the search and rescue team as well, the most common calls we get are minor trip slips and falls that lead to broken ankles or legs, or heat-related injuries or illnesses. That's the big one.
It's 110 in August there all day.
Yep, it is hot, but people don't think of us like we're not a desert. We're a semi-arid environment, so people are very underprepared. There are days where Badlands is hotter than Death Valley on the same day.
Wow.
It's hot there. I've seen it at 114. Like, it's hot. And it's windy, so your sweat gets dried off really fast. You don't realize you're getting dehydrated until it's too late.
Yeah, she carried 3 liters of water,
so much water.
per person per day
literally,
in the desert.
We recommend
3 liters
a gallon
per person
per day,
Well, cool. Well, if I head there this next summer, will I see you there?
I should be there. Okay. You never want to say for sure because government job applications are weird, but I would love to be back there. It's my favorite place in the world, and you guys should definitely come out. We'll go fossil hunting. We'll do all sorts of fun stuff.
Cool, I'm there.
Find the next big thing. We'll write the next paper, right?
Hey, Hey, Madison, it has been such a blast talking to you. I'm so excited about the Badlands National Park and, you know, and Hell Pigs. Thanks for taking
a
moment.
I like your enthusiasm, too. I think that's what's great.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Infectious. Thank you. I always say, also, if you're being enthusiastic, then more people are going to care about what you're talking about. And it's so hard not to be enthusiastic about paleo and cool places like Badlands National Park. So thank you guys so much.
I mean, because we all share one thing in common, that we are big nerds.
We are big nerds.
Nerd power. Nerd power.
Exactly.
What kind of nerds?
Hey.
Paleo nerds.
Paleo nerds.
We are laughing and we're learning.